Hi guys, welcome to the Accounting Tech Tar Pit, presented by Early Adopters Hub, the accelerator for accounting tech. I'm your host, Jack Teal, and this is a podcast for accounting tech startup founders focused on no BS, candid conversations about the challenges and benefits of building a startup in the accounting industry. Welcome back. Pleased to be here with a fantastic guest who has been on a long and windy road over the past few years. Having previously been a director at Fathom, he was probably as well placed as you can be to build a successful accounting tech startup with intimate knowledge of the industry, ecosystem, and obviously very well connected. He achieved a number of major milestones on his startup journey, reaching over 5,000 users in more than 50 countries and being recognized as a top 5 accounting software innovation in 2021. But after 3 years, has now exited Connect 4 with a recent announcement of its handover to Sumo Tech. Although it didn't end as planned, based on the original plans, we're all thankful that we have people like Andrew Jordan who are willing to speak about their experience to help the next generation of founders who are out there building tech for accountants. So, Andrew, great to have you here.
Thanks, Jack. I'm scared if I'm on a long and windy journey and I'm only in 31. So hopefully there's a longer journey to go. But pleased to be here.
Good perspective. Well said. And I suppose maybe to get the conversation going, you know, I usually ask founders, especially early stage ones, you know, how they ended up running a startup. But in your case, given you've kind of been on this journey and now you're at the other end of it, you know, if you were to break it down into a few chapters and kind of go through, you know, those key, maybe the key milestones, the key challenges that you had along the way, kind of how would you break up the startup journey?
Good question. I think, for me, I was already in a software company. Like you mentioned in the intro, I was working at Fathom, which is a management reporting company. My journey started from a pain point that I experienced whilst in that software company. So I was already in software and I spotted a pain point. So, okay, so that's step one. Step two was doing something with that. So a lot of people don't get to step two. A lot of people, you know, note a pain point and don't do anything with it, which is fine because it's it can take you off on a long and windy journey, as you've said. Step two was to kind of do something with that idea. So during the first, what was a lockdown here in the UK, I started developing that idea in my evenings and started to kind of unpack whether there was something around. What we were looking at was kind of meeting management. So how do we create almost a two-sided document, kind of documenting of meeting output between client or third party and organization. So that process started. I went on an accelerator program with Cambridge University here, which was a week-long intensive. So I already had a business plan and I started to put that to test. Then for me, I'm not a developer. So I spent some money, my own money, on getting an outsourced development team to build a prototype. Things went quite well. So I started using my network to get some early users. So that was probably back, you know, in May 2020, something like that. And then by September, we had our first paying customer. So that was probably the end of phase one, getting to first paid customer. And I'd invested, I think something like about £50,000 at that point. So I'd invested quite a bit, but I was still working at Fathom part-time. The founders there were really, Dan, Dave and Jeff were really kind of open and I kind of was sharing what I was up to. So I was doing the two at the same time. And then I went, by the end of that year, I was in full-time and I tried to bring on two co-founders, which I did, a CTO and a COO. And then that's when I raised some money, some angel investment money. And we launched what we called our seed partner platform. So we got early paying customers to prove out what we were doing. And we got about 20, 25 of those. So that was probably phase two, getting early customers, early paying customers and raising some money. And then phase three is probably the grind where you realize, oh, wait, I've got some money and now there's expectation. So that was probably phase three, was where you've got your early paying customers. Actually, you've got some decent usage and actually doing quite well. But then to try and actually to grow it, and you also get into some technological problems, for example, in our case, and you realize your ideal customer is pretty broad and you get pulled in different directions. That was probably three for us. And then phase four was deciding, I wasn't enjoying this as much as I'd hoped. The fundraising environment's tough, and I started thinking about, well, is this product, does this business model make sense? Is this product better suited with someone else? So that was probably phase four. So that was the life cycle of Connect Four with my involvement. It lives on, as you've mentioned, but that was my life cycle with it.
Yeah, and it obviously sounds like it actually got off the ground pretty well, in the early stages, phase one and two. I imagine, you hit the targets that you had at that point. So once you raised money, things got a little bit more difficult, or was that an immediate change, or can you talk us through that?
The thing about raising money is that it takes you away from doing anything in the business, really. It's really time consuming. And for us, that was okay to an extent. I took a strategy of raising money from angel investors. So we raised money from about 25 angel investors, about 500,000 GBP. And to be honest, that worked well for us. It did work well for us because we had some great people behind us, most of whom were CEOs, executives, or founders of software companies themselves, and they did really help us. But that did take me out of the business, and there were some probably fundamental challenges we had. One specifically was around we were spending a lot of time trying to reinvent web video, basically, whereas it's already commoditized, and that brought us a lot of challenges. And maybe if I'd been a little bit more on the ball with the business, I would have realized, look, we need to start integrating with third-party video providers earlier. So that's one example. So it does. So the challenges weren't necessarily with the fundraising, although that was, there was challenges there. We can talk about them. The challenges was that took me out of the business and it didn't let me focus on some of the real business decisions that needed to be made in that kind of period as things were going quite well with customers. But yeah, there were product challenges.
So do you think it was that close? Like, is it, if you reflect and look back in hindsight, it's easy to do now. But you look at Zoom and Teams and how they both kind of took off during COVID, and you were, potentially, if you look at that as those two products took off, that potentially you're actually really well placed. The opportunity was there for a video conferencing tool for accountants to kind of hit the market at the right time. Why do you think it didn't actually pan out that way?
Well, if you look at kind of what products do well when there's like an external change, so obviously lockdown is quite a big external change, and that set up things like Zoom and Teams well, and other platforms like Hopin is one good example from the UK that became like an overnight success. But your product's already got to be at a point of stability. It's got to be at a point of interoperability with other platforms that people are using. Within working with accounting firms, it's got to be, particularly accounting firms' clients, it's got to be reliable. So your product has to be at a certain point to capture a change in the external environment. And we just weren't at that point. We'd done some great things. If you're thinking about kind of the three levers that you're always trying to juggle as a startup founder, it's kind of you're always thinking about you're thinking about sales, you're thinking about marketing, and then you're also thinking about product, and you're always trying to bring one up without getting one too far ahead of the other. You're always trying to bring the three up, so it's the bottom one that kind of makes you lose. So we kind of brought sales and marketing up well, but technology needed to be brought up as well. So we weren't really in the best place to make the most of that shift, if that makes sense.
Andrew, to ask you on that, when did you realize that your approach to video was potentially wrong? And how much, and a follow-up question on that is, how much do you think the sunken cost impact your decision on this?
It wasn't the sunken cost. It was there were some customers that loved our web-based video, so that it wasn't that we'd spent so much money on this technology and then using this programmable video API and building our own code around it and auto correcting from different devices and different countries and all the things we had to do. It wasn't that. It was more that we only had 25 customers and 10 of them loved web video, so at that point, it was really hard for us to go, all right, we're willing to lose these 10 customers. So it was more the fear of letting some customers go when you're in an early stage and you're always looking to show signs of traction, based on, well, revenue is an obvious one, but also like usage and stuff. So it was the worry that we'd lose paid customers. So that was the problem.
So what made you decide to switch away from your own video?
So we got to a point where we were probably at all-time record usage. There were, you know, over 100 meetings happening every week on our platform. And we realized that actually to kind of really get things going, we needed to work with the Microsoft suite particularly. If we wanted to work with some of the larger firms, there's Microsoft was so embedded, which was great. And we realized actually it wasn't that, annoyingly, it wasn't that difficult to do technically to work with Microsoft and Zoom. And there were quite quick wins we could do. So that's when we did them, basically, all of about 18 months later than we should have.
So when you look back on that decision initially to kind of hang on to a few users, I'm sure, you know, there's other early stage founders who are going to have this experience. They're going to have multiple customer profiles and they have to choose, or they have to make a decision as to what to prioritize next, which may only favor one group when, as you said, you're kind of in that position where you want to maximize users as much as possible. What would your advice be to those people going through that?
Well, I think, and some of the our angel investors put it well, I think focusing on a metric that isn't revenue is key. So you need, Amplitude often call it the North Star metric. You need a metric that really represents value as opposed to money. And we never really nailed it. But an example for us that we played with was something like number of repeat meetings per client. You know, that's one example. It's got to be something that elicits value from what your product's offering. And we always were constantly trying to tweak and change, and you should do this, your North Star, but we never really nailed it. So try and get away from having a North Star or having a key primary KPI as anything to do with revenue, and that will really help you test the right levers. But that's incredibly difficult as soon as you raise money, just to let you know. You can build a whole narrative around this metric and have showing a chart of the hockey stick of this metric rather than revenue. And some investors will like that. But a lot will just say, have you got to 10K MRR yet? Have you got to a million ARR? And that's the investor mindset. So, yeah, it's tricky if you take money, but otherwise have a North Star that's value driven. That's your key metric as a startup.
Yeah, really, really interesting. I want to kind of change tack a little bit now. We've spoken a lot about the product and a lot about that investment journey and the challenges that have come with it. So, you were building a product for the accounting industry, and that makes a lot of sense given your background with Fathom and background before that as well. Do you have a specific perspective to share on the opportunities or challenges of working with accountants with respect to other markets?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I've experienced firsthand the pain of now. Like, I mean, I think people think selling to accountants is easy to an extent because they have spending power, because they're recession proof, because it's a rising tide, because there's compliance services, there's always going to be security of funds. But the reality is that they have a finite amount of software spend, and there are some key products they're already spending that on. So they've got, you know, their key accounting software, their document storage, you know, certain things that they're not going to budge with their software spend. So then you realize you're actually playing with a very small percentage of their expenditure on potential new tools to solve pain points. So you're in a small pool of cash, basically. And then you need to be, you know, top three of their pain points to be considered to be, you know, to spend on. So I think the thing I learned is that accountants would be very giving of their time, because actually they do really like process, and they do like using, you know, implementing stuff that will drive efficiencies, give a better client service, etc. They do really want those things, so they will give their time to talk to you about it. But when it comes to the spend, that's another question for a lot of firms, particularly if it's a partnership. I know there are a lot of modern firms that aren't in that model, but if you're down the small end of the accounting firm market as a customer base, but even then you're competing with probably you know, 100 other solutions, but they're only going to pay for three top three pain points. So you better be in the top three.
Did you do anything to try to understand where you sat in that priority list for firms? Because you did mention, I think it's phase two, you had 20 to 25 people paying for it at that early stage. So yeah, what changed there, or what happened there to kind of make you feel that maybe we're not solving a big enough problem?
I think, I think it's right. We're potentially right that we weren't serving a big enough problem to be a standalone product at that point. So I think, I mean, this is a whole topic in itself, but a lot of accounting firms were looking at practice management software over the last 5 years. You know, that's an increasing trend of practice management software adoption for a number of reasons, but mainly because CRMs don't cut it and they need a better way of tracking work and client engagement. So practice management is an understood software category now for accountants. And we weren't a practice management software. We were adding on to the practice management ecosystem, essentially. We did a lot with Carbon, for example, on their APIs. And I think even though people wanted to improve the meeting efficiency and productivity, you can see why you would. And the thesis still stands. Like, it still makes sense as a hypothesis what we're doing. And that's why we still have customers on the product. But we were kind of behind the practice management spend. Practice management's only just growing now, really. And you needed to be using your practice management software well, normally, and then adding on Connect 4 to, as like a bolt on to improve your meetings. So yes, we were a pain point, but I probably thought we were higher up the list than we were at that point for the majority of firms. For some, obviously, we were higher up the list as a pain point, but yeah.
I mean, one more question on this before changing direction a little bit. I am wondering, so where does price fall into this? Because at the end of the day, it comes down to that balance between the value you're offering, like the size of the problem, the significance, and, you know, how expensive you are. Obviously, the size of the problem helps you move up the priority list, but the price can help to kind of potentially make the decision a little bit easier. So did you guys play around with pricing to try to entice accountants?
Yeah, we did. I don't know. I think price can sometimes be misleading to be too focused on early on, because accountants value their time. Like, they're based on, you know, a lot. The old model of accounting is, you know, you have a charge out rate. I'm back working in an accounting firm now, constantly talking around a staff member's charge out rate. What's their value for an hour of their time? So I think if people understand there's a pain point, you can get their engagement before the price conversation. That said, I think you do give an indication of what type of product you are through your price on your website, particularly if you are going to list a price on your website. They kind of then make a mental model, a comparison. If you're going to be, you know, a spend that's equivalent to what they're spending on general ledger accounting software at the moment, well, then they're going to be making a comparison. Are we going to get as much value from this product as we are from using Xero or QuickBooks or something? So there is kind of a comparison that goes on in their head that helps, especially if you're a new category, that helps a customer kind of put you in a box. We probably didn't play with that enough, but you have to realize you're spinning a lot of plates. And if you're constantly changing price, it also creates confusion with current customers and some potentially resentment. And you can get a lot of differences in pricing, which is not useful either for building trust. So, I mean, the way we did it is we had a seed partner plan, which was a set price per month. And then we had a seed partner light plan. That's where we started. And we had two simple pricing models, and that worked well. You could have like a limited version of our product based on the number of clients, or you could have an unlimited. And that's where we got off the ground. That worked well. And then we tried to create tiers. That didn't work so well. We tried to build in complexity, possibly too soon. And we were probably overpriced, but that's easy to say. You know, you could argue some practice management software is overpriced. So it depends what category we put ourselves in at that point.
Yeah, it is interesting. And we've probably got our own thoughts on this, and we won't go into it in detail, but obviously, there's a lot in the startup ecosystem that's very much about, you know, test, measure, learn, and try different things. And pricing is a tough one to to constantly test, because as you said, it messes with existing customer bases and is changing your expectations, and all these kinds of things happen every time you, but you know, shift the pricing model. So very interesting. And with only a few minutes left, I obviously want to get into kind of how the journey with Connect 4 wrapped up and how, where it is now and how the last few months have been. So I suppose, you know, can you kind of clarify the situation? Where is it now and what has happened over the past few months?
Yeah, sure. So probably last British summer, so June 2022, I started to think, well, we'd done a restructure at the beginning of that year, so we had to let go of some of the team, and they didn't want to leave. Like we were a really close team, and we love working with each other, and I had to let go of, you know, four people in the team basically, and so that was really tough in terms of then it didn't really feel like, you know, this kind of family going on this journey anymore. It didn't feel like this kind of cohesive unit progressing together. We just got to grind through this, and we're going to get there. And things, you know, I think underlying metrics were okay. They weren't bad at all. And so, you know, we were probably up about 40 customers by this point. Things are looking good. Users in different countries. It was looking quite good. But the underlying metric, the revenue coming in, wasn't enough to sustain where we were at. And I thought we needed to get to profitability rather than raise more money. I didn't want to raise more money at that point. So we got to June and I realized I'm not really enjoying this. I'm doing the job of three people now. And the fundraising landscape's getting tough, and I don't know if I want to do a next big round, basically. So I got to that point, well, what's the other alternative? The other alternative is to sell the business, essentially. Or, you know, there's some other strategies, but that's where we landed. And so I started to explore that, and there were a couple of avenues for that, mainly working with practice management software, so we had some deep integrations with. And we got quite far along with that process, basically, the macro environment wasn't in our favor at all, with redundancy cuts being made, funding, you know, subsequent funding rounds not progressing as expected. So there was a potential kind of avenue we were going down that actually didn't happen at the last minute. So then we actually started looking at alternatives, and that's where a few other players came in. Sumatech is a new practice management add-on suite. So they're building things like desk booking, things like client onboarding software around the practice management ecosystem, because practice management leaves a lot of areas out. And they, and Nathan Keeley, who's leading that business, I thought he was a good fit to take Connect 4 on to the next level as part of a wider suite. I thought our business model made more sense. So that happened at the end of last year. They bought Connect 4, and that allowed me to consult to them for a while, and then move on to a new gig, which I did a couple of weeks ago.
So I guess why not raise again? So you mentioned there that you made the decision not to, and ultimately that led to, you know, handing it over to somebody else. And this is something that comes up a lot with early stage founders: is do I, you know, early in the journey, do I raise to keep going, keep this thing alive, or I haven't progressed far enough in the early days, so I'm just going to even wrap it up and close up shop and go back and get a job. So do you have any thoughts on that? Like, why did you make that decision?
I think I'm reasonably rational when it came to the startup, you know, payoffs, like the costs going on. Like, I think sometimes you can end up in a startup bubble and everything in the media just tells you have to grind through it and you make it. And that's not the reality, like, at all. Like, for me, I was trying to leave my emotions, you know, aside of the startup journey a bit more. And for me, I was always, as a, you know, big investor in Connect 4 as well, I invest a lot of money. I was always doing the opportunity cost of, do I think this business model is going to work? Is there a pivot I can make to make the business model work? Or am I better off getting a paid job and having stability or trying something new in the future? So I was always doing this opportunity cost calculation, and I was still a massive, you know, I was still by far majority shareholder in Connect 4. Yes, we'd raised money. We were in an okay place. I think we probably could have raised money. It would have been difficult. We possibly could have. The external environment was really tough. We possibly could have, though. However, I just got to a point where I didn't believe in our business model would work in the short term. I think we would have needed 3 more years of me grinding. and I didn't want to do it, basically. And that's okay. Like, I think I've spoken to, literally this week, I was talking to someone who I think he'd gone through the early adopter hub process as well. And they were struggling with traction. And I think he was in about year, you know, he was quite a few years in. And I was just, I think some startup founders don't realize they have to carry on. Like, you don't have to do this. Like, it's not like you've been conscripted to software life as a startup founder. You can let go and try something new, or you can put it on the back burner or something. And so for me, that was the obvious choice. I had an 8-month-year-old now, and I was completely consumed by this early stage startup with a small team. And I knew I was probably going to have to do that for 2-3 more years to get to where we needed to. And I didn't want to do that. So I felt the business model didn't make sense any longer. I wasn't getting the payoff. And I thought it was better as part of another solution for our customers. And for that reason, I started to look at exit routes. And we did have one very good exit route lined up, like I said, and that didn't happen. So then I kind of had to quite quickly pivot to another exit route. So yeah, that was my journey with it.
I think a really good, honest, description of where you were and how you made the decision. It's probably one of the first things we ask founders that we work with is, you know, why are you doing this? What do you want out of life? Kind of, you know, that's where it begins. And that North Star, yes, you've got a North Star for your product and what you're trying to achieve, but you got that North Star for yourself as well. It's like 3 years in when the grind really hits you to know, is my life moving towards the direction I wanted it to as well? Not just the product. So no, that's really good to hear. And, obviously glad that the product lives on and there will still be customers getting value from it. So it sounds like a good fit where it is. And I guess just one final question for you, and then we'll wrap it up, is, you know, if you look back across that entire journey, this podcast is all about mistakes and helping new founders identify, you know, the pitfalls and problems that other founders have faced and dealt with and maybe didn't overcome or maybe have. Is there anything in particular that you kind of look back on and think that was a really critical mistake that I made, and so any other founder should really try and avoid that?
It's not that simple. it's not one juncture point where you go, if I didn't do that, everything would have green, you know, roses. I don't think it's that simple. I think anyone who's listening to this and has started on the journey, you realize you're probably making between, you know, probably around 50 big decisions each week. I found, like, if you're a, you know, really a solo founder early on, there's a lot of big decisions. If I revisited it, I actually think one thing, and a lot of people won't agree with this, I think one thing is, if you're going to be an early stage startup that's iterating quickly and you want high energy, working remotely is quite tricky to do, to create that environment as a team. I've heard a lot of early stage founders say the same thing, that it's actually, and there are some that do this well, but for me, I get a lot of energy from other people. So I probably would have tried to create, a higher energy in-person culture earlier on, that you can iterate quicker. You can get kind of quicker feedback. You're not interpreting nuance from text on Slack or Teams or whatever. So that's one thing I would probably seriously consider if you're starting up, is actually to kind of try and meet in person really regularly as a team to kind of iterate through. And then the second is, just because accountants say they value something, it doesn't mean they do until they, just because they're a really friendly group of people, especially if you've got a network there already. And that's a great characteristic to have, that they're willing to give their time and give feedback. But you do need to start ranking that problem against the other problems they have.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a big thing on the research that we do with a lot of the founders that we work with, is not asking people, do you want to buy it? seeing if they'll actually buy it is a much better indication of whether or not they will actually do it. So, and I love the perspective on building a culture in person. It's a really interesting take, and something that Johan and I deal with regularly working remotely with each other. So thanks, Andrew. Really good to chat to you. Some awesome lessons in there, and all the best for what lies ahead.
Thanks, guys. And anyone listening, good luck with the journey. It is a lot of fun. There are a lot of it's a roller coaster, but there are a lot of highs along the way. So yeah, wish anyone luck. And if they do want to message me, find me on LinkedIn, ping me a message, more than happy to help.
Cool. Thanks, Andrew. Thank you once again for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed the episode. If you are a potential founder in your early stages of developing a product or elsewhere in the journey struggling to achieve product market fit, we would love for you to reach out at www.earlyadoptershub.com. This has been another episode of the Accounting Tech Tar Pit, presented by Early Adopters Hub, the accelerator for accounting tech.